Good afternoon. I'm Dan Gibbons from the City Club of Chicago, and I'd like to welcome you on behalf of our Board of Governors, including the one and only Dr. Ed Mazur. Dr. Mazur, welcome to City Club. Welcome back to City Club to so many of you whose faces we've seen plenty. We have so many great programs and so much to tackle this week, next month, next year, and we continue to do it all together. So it's hard, you know, it's September 11th, right? And I never know exactly what to do on September 11th. For me today, this week was a little extra emotional. I suddenly lost my aunt yesterday, Janet Joyce, who was a teacher, amazing teacher, and anyone who was here yesterday heard me talk about her for a minute. But she was also a teacher, which I understand is public service, right? And she's married to a firefighter who became the fire commissioner, my Uncle Jim, and he was the commissioner of the Chicago Fire Department on 9/11. And my cousin Jimmy, her son, had an office in the World Trade Center. He was not at work that day, thank God. I saw him last night because he came back to town. It all kind of brought things together. Public service, family, loss. Everyone has dealt with loss. So many of us we're talking about gun violence today, and everybody's been affected by gun violence. There's stats that I'm not aware of, but there's a 9/11, I don't know what exactly it is, but too often because of the guns that we have. But it is 9/11, and we lost so many great people, so many innocent people, innocent bystanders, and then first responders, right? So I'd like for everyone to actually maybe stand up if you're able, and let's take a moment and think about the memory of all those amazing people and their families, and the public servants and the first responders and their families. And now this morning I heard grandchildren talking about their grandparents that they never met, because it was 23 years ago. So please take this moment and think about all of those amazing people that lost their lives that day. And before sitting down, I always, it was City Club, we looked to the past, right, to inform the future. What we're doing in this room is making a difference. And I'm going to mention something in a minute, a couple of examples of that. But in honor of all of those people and all what you all are doing, I'm just going to ask everyone to say hello to somebody at a table next to you, because what I've learned about what's happening here at City Club is actually making a difference where the rubber meets the road, and what we're doing to carry this all forward, public service and in our own ways, is done because of all of you in this room, but you all need to know each other. So I'm going to ask you for one more minute to turn to somebody at a table next to you and say hello and introduce yourself. Hopefully you met somebody amazing. And hopefully you stick around after the program and meet some more folks. And hopefully you come back tomorrow for Carrie Steele, or next week for the Park Superintendent Rose Escareño, or the Speaker of the House Chris Welch. And hopefully you keep coming and you keep meeting great people. And hopefully you may have met someone like Eileen O'Neill Burke, who's here running for state's attorney, or Dwayne Deskins, who is my go-to expert on all things gun violence and crime. Lester McKeever. So many amazing people that are here in the room, and so much history. David Griesing, foundations. Alderman Rodriguez is here. Thank you, Alderman. Any other elected officials? If there are any elected officials, please stand or raise your hand. Thank you. I can't see with the lights. Please, thank you. Thank you for being here. And thank you all for your service. Thank you to our sponsors. Of course, we couldn't do this without the sponsors that, like White and Company, Pat and Matt Cermak, the Joyce Foundation, I'll get to in a minute, Think Inc., and I will take a second here, Lori Glenn. This is our fifth, I think maybe our sixth program that we've done in sort of conjunction with Lori, who's brought us some amazing ideas, and that's how we do things here at City Club. So please bring those ideas, and we will have the conversations. It may not be next week or next month, but we'll get to them because there's so many great conversations to have. Thank you, Lori, for all that you've done and all that you've continued to do to make City Club better and make this city better. Chicago Cred is here. They are always doing amazing things, as is, of course, University of Chicago Crime Lab right up in front. Thank you. The Cook County Justice Advisory Council in the middle back here. Metropolitan Peace Initiatives, I think right over here. Thank you all. Crown Family Philanthropies, right over here. Crown Family, one of Chicago's finest. And that's where I actually want to mention, when I said we're making a difference, making these connections, as just in conversation today, I learned that because of a program here that we did with Sheriff Tom Dart, the Crown Family Philanthropies heard him and talk about a couple of things and ended up funding his iPad program to the tune of, I'm not sure how much, but it doesn't matter how much. If there was one life that was changed or 1,000 lives that were changed, there's a difference. And that was because you all talked to each other. So I did that on purpose, all right? You see what I did there? That's what happens here at City Club, and there's so much more of that to come. So thank you for indulging me in all this, because it is important, right? So thank you, Crown Family Philanthropies, and Respublica Group, of course, as well. Thank you all. And I'm going to go back to the Joyce Foundation for a minute, because this is a partnership. This is something that we've been talking about with the Joyce Foundation now. This is the second of a three-part series. I'm imagining there's more to come. Tim Daly and the Joyce Foundation has been very instrumental in this, their commitment to so many issues, but especially gun violence here in the Midwest and around the Great Lakes is incredible. And we are proud to partner with you all, as we are with the WTTW. Brandis, where are you? I know you're getting ready because she's a professional. She's like, man, he's up there just rambling. I've got it down. We're going to welcome Brandis up here to moderate this conversation in just a minute. So thank you to Brandis. Thank you to WTTW. Thank you all for being in the room today as we tackle some of these very important issues. So let me get around now to the panel, and we're in good hands with Brandis. I'll step off here in a minute, but if I could ask Brandis to come up and also ask you to all welcome our panelists. Brendan Kelly, welcome Brendan back, the director of the Illinois State Police. Christopher Amon, the special agent in charge of the ATF Chicago Field Division. And Kim Smith, the Director of Programs for the University of Chicago Crime Lab. If I could welcome you all to the stage, thank you, Brandis, for coming back. And I have a couple of questions for you already, Brandis. And if anyone else has questions that you've not submitted, please do so. Write them out. Hand them to myself or Amanda, and we'll make sure to get them up to Brandis and hopefully incorporate them into this conversation that I'll hand over to you now. Thanks.
Oh, awesome. Thank you. Later. Got questions for later. No peeking. I always feel like it's almost like the Price is Right. Does anybody else get that feeling when we get called to come on down? Thank you. You couldn't see me in the corner in the day glow yellow. And shout out to my WTTW colleagues who are here to make sure I don't mess up. Thank you. So I think you know who our guests are, yeah? So I'll go ahead and jump into questions, because I'm not... Do you want to introduce yourselves, or... No.
Okay.
They know who you are. I mean, briefly, Director Brendan Kelly, Illinois State Police.
Brendan Kelly, Illinois State Police.
Good job.
All right.
Christopher Ammon, ATF. That's Ammon, like salmon, without the S.
Okay.
And Kim Smith, common spelling, from the University of Chicago Crime Lab.
That is the question I ask people during interviews, too. It's like, normal spelling?
Mm-hmm.
So let's set the stage a little bit, please. And I don't think it's lost on anyone in this room that we are having this conversation, as we've discussed, you know, on the 23rd anniversary of 9/11, but also, what is it, just a week after a tragic shooting at a high school in Georgia. I think the case can be made, though, that gun violence is gun violence, but the reasons for some of these shootings, the reason that they happen are different. But I want to talk about, obviously, you know, what's happening in Illinois and the use of illegal guns, of course. And I want to ask each of you to sort of set the stage for us from your perspective. How would you describe or qualify the flow of illegal guns in Illinois? And I should mention, just last week, Chicago Police Department said that so far this year, almost 8,500 illegal guns have been taken off the streets, which is slightly ahead of where we were this time last year. So if I can, I'm going to start with you, Director Kelly.
Well, I think you can think about the flow. It's a good metaphor to use as sometimes a mighty river that has many sources, out of state, in state, stolen firearms, person to person transfers, background checks that may or may not have been done in the past, but are now done as a part of the process that we have in the state of Illinois. And I think the overall gun safety a paradigm that has been built out in the state over many years and increasingly in more recent years, more measures put in place, that it's just cutting off individual tributaries that are flowing into that stream of firearms that are used in a crime. And the Illinois State Police, we have a large role in that process in terms of the various screens and perimeters that are established between the unlawful possession of a firearm and public safety. And I think all of those measures are increasingly more effective. There's many, you know, different aspects of that we can talk about. But I know that this particular group and Joyce Foundation and others have been very interested in the issue of gun dealer licensing. And that was a process and a series of statutes put in place and a regulatory process put in place several years ago. And it is very hard to measure sometimes how the flow is being cut off or not cut off. You know, this came through here, but where did it really come from? We may have cut off this stream or that stream, but what's left? And that can be hard to measure causation sometimes, to connect those dots to individual tragedies and crimes. But we do know, just looking at the gun dealer legislation, for example, and we can talk about other things also, but since that process has put in place, we know before gun dealer licensing was put in place, there are a little over 2,000 FFLs in the states, people that are federally licensed to deal in firearms. And that number is down to about a little under 1,000 at this point. So with the 1,000 that are left and the hundreds of inspections that we are doing of those gun dealers, that doesn't necessarily mean we're finding a lot of violations, but it means the ones that have decided not to be FFLs anymore, they simply have made a choice that they are not willing to abide by those regulations, and they've ever gone elsewhere, they've gone out of business. I think there's some good data that our partners at the ATF have that indicate by doing those inspections and by having more safety measures in place, that has prevented, what has often been a problem with thefts occurring at those locations. And if anything, that's just, again, one little stream that is feeds the overall challenge that we have that is, I think, slowly but surely been tightened and is leading to some tangible results.
And to get specific, because this is fairly fresh, really new numbers that you're sharing with us. So breaking news, everyone. You said pre-gun dealer licensing implementation, data showed that there were 2,257 FFLs under your old data system.
Give or take.
Yeah. as of today, only 988. So from almost 2260 to 988.
Yeah. And I think that's an indication, and also the inspection regime that we do of those gun dealers are still here. Again, there's very few violations we're finding because they are abiding by that. But I think it does also lead to our interaction with them, some good intelligence, some good relationship building. Some gun dealers are saying, hey, I'm abiding by these rules, but you know, ABC gun dealer down the street, I've heard they maybe have some problems, or they ask for help at times. You know, I want to make sure I'm doing this correctly. How can I do this correctly to make sure that we're not putting a gun in the hands of someone who's going to use it to hurt themselves or to hurt others?
Special Agent Ammon, same question to you, really, kind of, you know, set the stage for us.
So to Director Kelly's point about the flow of firearms specifically into Illinois and Chicago, so there's basically three ways that firearms are coming here. You talk about unlicensed dealing, so individuals who are dealing firearms without a license. Federal law mandates that you have a license if you're going to engage in the business of dealing firearms. Second would be straw purchasing. So what is commonly, you know, having someone who's able to purchase firearms, purchase a firearm for someone who's prohibited. And the third, and this is to the point that Director Kelly made about the licensing, is theft. So that's thefts from vehicles. That's also thefts and burglaries of federal firearms licensees. So one of the top line, very important numbers based on the regulatory enforcement here in this state, they were able to put security measures in place for federal firearms licensees, something that by statute we can't do federally, but they can do here in Illinois. So what has the result been of that? ATF has to respond to every single FFL theft that occurs. So prior to the enactment of the regulatory enforcement, there were 35 per year in Illinois. Last year, there were 12, and this year, one. Entire state. And that has to do with some of the security measures that are part of the statute here in Illinois. So nationwide, obviously we know that everybody in this room knows there's a patchwork of state laws. There's the overarching federal law. But states like Illinois that are kind of on the front end of this are actually preventing the diversion of those firearms into the illegal market during that subset. Now we still have to deal with unlicensed dealing, straw purchasing, which is still, unfortunately, rampant in our country and here locally. You mentioned at the top, over 12,000 firearms recoveries every year in Chicago. You know, the majority of those guns actually, you know, coming based on our recent data from in-state, but also states, neighboring states, and then states throughout the country. So part of our strategy is to use our crime gun intelligence tools, and there's two main tools that we use. Our e-trace system, which is how we trace firearms. So when a firearm is recovered, you take that information, the make, model, manufacturer, serial number, enter it into our e-trace system, and it gets us back to the original retail purchaser of that firearm. Just to give you an example of that in action, everybody in this room is familiar with the Highland Park massacre that occurred. We traced that firearm, which was helped law enforcement identify the suspect in that case. We do that 9,000 times a year here in Chicago in routine cases to identify trafficking networks. But, you know, as the director said, it's tributaries. It's not one pipeline. I think we often mistake for there must be this pipeline of, you know, people driving up the interstate, but it's far more complicated. And I'll just give you three examples from recent cases without getting into the specifics, but it can be as simple as a father who purchases a firearm as a gift for his son. His son drives that onto the south side of Chicago, doubles the price of that firearm, sells it for double, and then that's used, associated with the homicide of a police officer. It can be an individual setting up in a gun show and dealing without a license out of an inventory without conducting background checks. Those guns are later found on the streets of Chicago and other cities in Illinois. So it can also be someone in Illinois recruiting someone with a firearms identification card to go purchase firearms. So very complicated on how it happens, but here at ATF, we try to combat that by working with our partners at the state police and other law enforcement agencies.
Kim.
I brought a few slides, being from the University of Chicago. Can't go anywhere without data.
Without research, yep.
and I don't know if I can advance them. Okay, great.
You just say it and it happens.
Yeah, say it and it happens. So I think as has been stated, and I just want to reiterate, because we have a tendency as researchers to kind of march through data, but the data that we're talking about are people's lives. So every homicide, every non-fatal shooting is a family, a group chat, a friend group. that has just been deeply impacted forever. So I just want to state that up the front, that when we talk about data, these are experiences and these are entire communities who've lost very important people. So in terms of, you know, why we focus on gun violence, and I think this is a really well-timed panel, we start from kind of the national perspective. So what you're looking at right now is a graph of homicide rates in higher income countries around the world, and you can see this is a case of American exceptionalism for all the wrong reasons. We are an outlier when it comes to our homicide rate. If you go to the next slide, and you can see that this is entirely due to our gun homicide rate. So the gray portion of the slide is the share of homicides that are due to non-gun reasons, and the yellow is the share of homicides in each country caused by firearms. So what we have in this country, we're not a more violent country, we are a more lethally violent country, and that is because the presence of guns. Another point, if you look at the difference between Chicago's homicide rate compared to New York, Los Angeles, Philadelphia, Houston, you'll see a very similar pattern. In Chicago, our non-gun homicide rate is almost exactly the same as New York and Los Angeles. The reason we have such a higher homicide rate than those two cities that we like to compare ourselves to, again, is because of gun homicides. So being really focused and precise about what the cause of our challenge is here. If we go to the next slide. As was kind of referred to earlier, so this is thinking specifically about Chicago. We've done some work with the city of Chicago, the Chicago Police Department over the years, trying to understand, you know, there are no gun stores in the city limits, but Chicago PD recovered thousands of guns every year. Where are those guns coming from? What we're seeing is a few things. So the first is that when we did this analysis in 2017, 60% of firearms that are recovered by Chicago PD are actually coming from outside of the state of Illinois. You see states like Indiana, Wisconsin, Michigan, Mississippi represented. But the primary source state of illegal firearms recovered in Chicago is Illinois. So 40% of those firearms are coming from Illinois, and in fact, many of them are coming from suburban Cook. So there are both interstate dynamics, the kind of flow into the state of Illinois, but as the director mentioned, within the state, there are also a number of FFLs that are supplying crime guns to Chicago. And I think this is a really important point to keep in mind, that there is a lot that we can do within our state government, and one of the things that we really focus on at Crime Lab is making sure that this information is getting into the hands of policymakers, government, who truly have the potential and the resources and the scale to transform lives and impact communities. I'm going to highlight a few troubling trends that we're seeing, and then would love to be able to talk about solutions, because we try to be very solutions-oriented as well. So if we go to the next slide. One of the things that we looked at the beginning of the year, my colleagues Jacob Miller and Jens Ludwig, was the number of crime scenes in the city of Chicago, shooting crime scenes, where over 20 shell casings were recovered. In 2010, about 15 years ago, about 1% of the shooting scenes that Chicago PD was responding to yielded over 20 shell casings. Now that number is 16%. And as you can see, the average number of shell casings has increased over that same time period. That means that there are more rounds being let out. It's more likely that someone can get hit, and it's also more likely that they can get hit multiple times, which we think is in part leading to a higher fatality rate. So that's the likelihood that someone dies when they are involved in a shooting incident. And I'll just end with this last slide, and I am happy to kind of go into more detail about some of the other trends we're seeing, including around high-capacity magazines. But our analysis suggests that because our fatality rate has increased, because we think there are more higher-capacity magazines available in the city, more Glock switches being used, more rounds being let out, we are seeing an increase in the fatality rate. So it used to be about 1 in 5 in 2010, and it used to be 1 in 7 in 2010, and now it's closer to 1 in 5. If our fatality rate had stayed the same as it was in 2010, 2010, sorry, we estimate that there would have been 84 fewer homicide victims in the city just last year. Because we have so many shootings that take place in Chicago, just a small increase in the fatality rate has incredibly detrimental impacts on our homicide rate and the number of families who lose loved ones every year. So those are some of the trends that I wanted to kind of bring to the conversation. But as I said, would love to talk about some of the promising solutions that we see as well.
Yeah, and I hope we can get to that as well. Special Agent, you want to add something?
Just to follow up on that and the importance of research and collaboration. And I'll shout out the University of Chicago Crime Lab sitting over here. That research they did specifically on lethality and machine gun conversion devices as one of the possible contributors is very important because we have seen an alarming rise in these devices. So this is a device that turns a semi-automatic pistol into a fully automatic pistol. Small device that you can affix to the back of a firearm that's having lethal consequences, as we all knew in law enforcement, but to have a team that looks at that and actually puts some data behind that and reviews all of these events is really important for informing us and how we appropriate our resources. Last week, the Department of Justice announced a machine gun conversion device nationwide initiative where they're directing the United States Attorney's offices to prioritize these prosecutions. Here at our Crime Gun Intelligence Center of Chicago, that I'll talk a little more about later, but we're also prioritizing those types of investigations. 2 weeks ago, we indicted an individual for opening fire with a machine gun at a gas station, over 50 rounds fired. Tragically, you've all heard of the line of duty law enforcement deaths that we've had, Officer Ariana Preston, Luis Huesca, and most recently Cook County Deputy Raphael Wardlaw. Machine gun conversion devices are all suspected of being used in those crimes and then hundreds of others in Chicago, the July 4th mass shooting that we had. So this is a big problem, and the research you've done really shows why, as law enforcement, we have to focus on it, and that's what we're doing, you know, with some big backing from the Department of Justice. But this is something that didn't exist 4 years ago. The rise of these devices started about the 2019 timeframe. Machine guns were basically outlawed in this country because of what was happening in Chicago in the 1930s, the Thompson submachine gun that was used in the gangland warfare that was going on here. Congress enacted the National Firearms Act, which essentially banned machine guns. You have to register them. You have to pay a tax. So for many years, this was in the rearview mirror of gun violence in America until about the 2020, and now it's a huge issue.
And if I could just underscore his point about this being virtually unheard of, these kind of recoveries of these Glock switches, makeshift machine guns. So last year, the Chicago Police Department recovered, I think, 450 of these Glock switches. So you can let out 100 rounds, don't need to reload at machine gun pace. And as he said, 10 years ago, that was unheard of. So it really is a very recent phenomenon.
Right. And I should point out, for those of you who don't know, the city of Chicago is attempting to sue the Glock manufacturer along with the stores that sell the guns that are located outside the city of Chicago as a matter of public safety. So something to keep an eye on and follow up on. Director Kelly, we've talked about a few things. The gun dealer licensing and certification law in 2019 requiring dealers to become certified with the ISP, of course. Also, you've told me that ISP has been instrumental in the Fix the Foyd Bio bill, bio standing for Block Illegal Ownership. Tell us a little bit about that legislation, and also where's the hole? What other legislation? What do you need?
Well, I think a lot was accomplished in that particular bill that addressed a variety of gaps. There's always additional work to be done, but for example, Illinois couldn't, even with the Foyd background check process and what's called the Firearms Transaction Inquiry Program (FTIP) that we run, where if you want to purchase a firearm at an FFL, you have to go through a background check. Even with that, we weren't quite a universal background check state. I think, you know, law enforcement, state police, we were sensitive to the fact that that was something that had broad, bipartisan support. And we were part of the discussions, brought our subject matter expertise to those negotiations that led to a system where someone who's doing a person-to-person transfer, meaning, John Q. Public is selling a gun to, Mr. Jones. The only system that was in place previously is that person was obligated to make sure they had a valid Foyd. and they could check online to see if they had a valid FOID. But now the person-to-person transfer online that we, whether you're in a rural community, urban community, or where you are, you can use that process electronically. And by law, you're required to do so to verify the current validity, not just show somebody that piece of plastic I kept in my wallet that said I'm a FOID card holder, but actually verifying that they are, that entering the information, and then making sure that particular firearm didn't bounce off our stolen gun database. And that is also a critical thing. That is a major stream of crime guns, are guns that are reported stolen or after the fact when we're using the e-trace process. When a crime occurs, we have the weapon, we look at the history of it, we go back to the last person who had it legally that we have documentation on, they say, well, it must have been stolen, or I lost it. They have an obligation to report it. That's a difficult law, as it's written, to be able to enforce, a difficult law for prosecutors to be able to charge those cases. But that is an area where we've tightened things up, and there really is no excuse now for someone who is selling a firearm to say that I didn't know that where this firearm went, and they should be reporting it stolen. And if you get to that point where you're investigating a case and you're following the track and it is reported stolen, then it should be easier to prove to that person that the person possessing it is the guilty of the offense of possession of a stolen firearm. There's regular unlawful possession of a firearm, and then there's an additional penalty for purchasing when it's stolen. And that has been tightened, but one area where it's, I think, more challenging for both investigators and prosecutors is they can claim, I didn't know it was stolen. Now, they have less of an excuse to do that now, but as it is under Illinois law, it currently says that if the serial number on the firearm is obliterated, that's evidence that a prosecutor can use to say, you have some knowledge. You know, if you have that firearm and the serial number is obliterated, clearly you had some indication that it was stolen or you were possessing it illegally. What should be part of that and clarified as a result of the strengthening of the stolen gun database that we have now as part of the process is that if that gun shows up in the database, then you should have had some knowledge as well. And that's just not quite clear the way the legislation is, and that's just something, a little tool that I think both investigators and prosecutors are missing in the process. It's unclear, and it's a critical part of the stream. It's one of the sources, one of these game of inches that we're playing here. This is one of those inches that we've got to close to make it easier to make sure when people do have their firearms stolen, they are reporting it, and then that can be put into the database, and then it's easier to show that someone is possessing that for criminal purposes.
Special Agent, you've talked a bit about the Crime Gun Intelligence Center in Chicago, and I think we get the idea of what crime gun intelligence is, but if you would, give us a brief understanding of what that is, but also I know you've talked about your E-Trace system and NIBIN, and I guess tell us kind of what is needed to make all of those tools even more effective. Is that possible?
Sure. So we talk about crime gun intelligence. There's two pillars. There's two main intelligence sources that we draw from to initiate our investigations and decide how we're going to use our resources as far as what ATF and our partners investigate. The first is E-Trace, as we've mentioned. So again, using E-Trace to go back to that original purchaser and try to identify those sources of diversion and firearm trafficking. The second and equally as important is NIBIN, which is our National Integrated Ballistic Information Network, which, to put it simply, is a database of fired shell casings from crime scenes and recovered firearms from across the country where we're able to link those shootings. So it's a database where we house all of this data and we're able to link it. So what comes out of that is a whole lot of investigative leads. So especially here in Chicago, as you can imagine, with 12,000 recovered firearms, 20% of those firearms that are recovered link via our NIBIN system to another shooting that occurred somewhere either here or regionally. So when you look at that, you talk about how do we collaborate now, knowing that we have these two huge intelligence sources that are helping us get at the source of the guns and the individuals pulling the trigger. So what ATF initiated here in Chicago and other places across the country with our partners is the opening of a Crime Gun Intelligence Center, which is basically state, local, and federal agencies all working together, intelligence professionals, investigators, attorneys, very important there, and our laboratory partners all working together to attack this problem. And what we do here in Chicago, we have 13 agencies that sit downtown. We meet every morning to review gun arrests and NIBIN leads, and we assign out leads, we assign cases. The Illinois State Police is a great partner in that effort. They've also stood up a similar crime gun center down in Springfield, so this concept has spread to other parts of the state. I'd also like to recognize Thor Martin from the state's attorney's office here, a great partner. John Carroll, who I saw in the back from the Illinois Attorney General's office, also another prosecutorial partner, part of our CJIC. But it's the concept. You know, we're here on the anniversary of 9/11, and I think one thing that came out of law enforcement post 9/11 was the reorganization towards that problem of terrorism. We knew before 9/11 people were siloed, intelligence wasn't shared. So there was a very important reformation that happened after that. So when we look at gun violence, one of the things we looked at was how do we collaborate on this? Because as the director mentioned, these sources out of state, in state, you're looking at a whole lot of different streams that we need to cut off, and we have to do that through collaboration. We have to talk to other crime gun centers. We're constantly talking with Indianapolis, very similar CJIC they have there when we have gun recoveries from Indy that are coming back here to Chicago. So it's a concept of cooperation, you know, built in the spirit of joint terrorism task forces, fusion centers like the state has, except it's for specifically for the problem of crime guns.
Director Kelly, you looked like you had something to add.
I agree.
Just want to be sure. You know, you can get in if you need to.
I'm that guy on Price is Right that just bids a dollar higher.
$1.
401. Yes. What he said.
What do we win when this is over?
Yeah. I think we get mugs, right?
Oh, yeah, we do get mugs. More mugs. Thank you. Good call. And Kim, I'm actually, before we pivot to questions, and thanks to those of you who have already submitted yours, if you have not, obviously you're welcome to do so, but I'm going to pivot to that shortly because there are a lot and I want to get to them. Question to you, though. What do we know about what works to stem the flow of guns, but also violence?
So I think the supply side innovations, programs, policies that my co-panelists talked about are really promising. And I would also add that there's a question. I don't have an answer. It's just, you know, very annoying of me to throw it out there. But a couple of years ago, we interviewed individuals who had been convicted of gun-related charges and who were in the Illinois Department of Corrections, came from Chicago. And we asked them, like, how did you get your gun? How much did you pay for it? Had you previously been involved in gun violence? Why did you choose to carry, like really trying to understand what went into the decision to purchase and then, you know, be caught carrying that gun without proper documentation in public. And we learned a lot, so I'll make a plug for those survey results. But something that we learned a lot about that we weren't expecting was around ammunition. Mm-hmm. And I think that is a really untapped area when we think about how to kind of reduce the likelihood that someone uses a firearm to resolve a dispute. Like, how do people access ammunition? How long does it take? So I would just throw that out there as another supply side question that I think is really promising to explore. But maybe taking a step back, so what do we know about a lot of the community violence that happens in a place like Chicago and so many other cities around the country? And I think there are a lot of misunderstandings about what the proximate cause of gun violence is. So of course, the structural and systemic challenges that many communities in Chicago that have a high concentration of gun violence kind of can lead to kind of create an environment where it is incredibly unforgiving and individuals are having to navigate challenging circumstances. So those root causes are really important. And when we look at the kind of proximate cause of gun violence, so what led to this shooting, we read the homicide narrative data many years ago, have talked to partners who are on the front lines, and altercations. It's altercations that turn deadly because a gun is at hand. Gun carrying in public, you use a gun to resolve a dispute. And I think that's really important because for a long time we've thought that gun violence is due to bad people. And what we're seeing is it's actually due to people making bad decisions and trying to navigate those decisions in unforgiving environments in maybe the kind of default way. And that's important because it has implications for programs and solutions. So if we think that we can change some of the decision-making calculus, then we think that police can deter. Maybe their presence might be able to deter that decision. We also think that individuals like community violence intervention, many of whom are represented in this room, can intervene in those high-stakes moments and either create a moment of pause or provide an individual with a different set of tools to navigate the circumstance. So I think the kind of proximate cause cause of gun violence being altercations tells us that things like community violence intervention, like behavior change interventions, can be really impactful. And then when we evaluate it, we see that that's actually the case. We found in many contexts and situations in Chicago that those types of programs that combine an individual, an adult in many instances, with really thoughtful cognitive behavioral or behavioral science tools can reduce gun violence and improve outcomes. So that's one of the things that we're hopeful will continue to be relied upon as a solution to this challenge.
A really good answer. Like, I feel like I got a lot out of that because it sounds like there's a couple of things.
There's a lot of layers.
Yeah, there's a lot of layers. But, I mean, it is pretty clear there are a couple of things at work, obviously. There is the proliferation of illegal guns, but then there are also the reasons that people grab one and that the gun is accessible.
Yes. Yeah. If you can reduce the likelihood that someone uses a gun to resolve a dispute by leveraging community violence intervention, by leveraging these behavioral science interventions, that's one thing. You can also reduce access to guns. And I think that's kind of the supply side. And using both of these is quite important.
I want to get to some of the questions that were submitted in advance, and thanks to those of you who did that. All right. Our first one, Josh Scharf of Brady. You hear Josh? Hey, how you doing? All right, excellent question. Thank you for raising your hand. How is ATF and ISP addressing gun dealers that sell firearms to straw purchasers and traffickers, especially where the purchase patterns and circumstances of the sales are suspicious and contain red flags that the transactions may be illegal?
So I think this is a challenge for us daily, again, because some of the circumstances that I described. Someone can legally go purchase a firearm. They go through the background check process. They purchase it. And then some point in that process, the firearm that they have winds up in the hands of someone who's using it for a crime gun. And then we trace it back to their process, and then we ask them. And sometimes they will say, I lost it. It was stolen. I don't know how they got this firearm. And that's where it makes it very difficult to get at sort of the straw purchasing phenomena, because that is often a challenge in being able to get over that burden of proof there and establishing, in fact, that they did buy it as a straw purchaser. There are certain red flags. There are gun dealers who I think have contacted us on a pretty regular basis to say, hey, something doesn't feel right about this one, or this person was in here with someone else. And I think the person that they were with is probably the real person who's going to get this firearm, not the person who's actually purchasing it, going through the background check. And that can lead us to pull on some strings and do some investigations. But it is a challenging thing. There's a reason why you don't see a lot of these straw purchaser charges, because you really at times have to have almost a straight up confession. Yeah, I bought it for my cousin. I bought it for my boyfriend. I bought it for my son. And I know that they couldn't get it legally, but I did it for them so they could have it for whatever reason. And that is just a challenge of that dynamic and being able to prove those cases. The laws are there, but establishing the evidence can be very tricky, in part because people can say, it was stolen. I lost it.
Our next question from Dwayne Deskins, former federal prosecutor. Hi. Thank you for your efforts to reduce gun violence. If your proposal passes, and we're talking about the mandatory locking of guns proposal, do you favor strict liability against parents whose children use guns to commit violence? Why or why not? Just going to leave that one out there.
I'm not familiar with that. Yeah, not familiar with that legislation. Yeah, I'd have to take a look at it. Yeah.
Okay.
I'm not familiar.
And I think we touched on it briefly last night on Chicago Tonight.
Yes, okay.
You can go to the website and look at it. But there, my colleague Nick Blumberg, referring to legislation requiring parents, mandatory locking up of guns, of course, requiring parents with children in the home. I think under the age of 18, all of them have to be locked up. And I guess sort of in, you know, maybe not legislation specific, but in a general sense, what kind of impact would something like that have if more parents were charged with locking up guns? Not charged in, like, the federal sense, but, I mean, in the court sense, but in charge of locking up a gun, being responsible for ensuring that child, how much does that happen, or how much is that a problem?
Plus one prices, right?
Okay, go.
No, I'll just say personally, you know, being a gun owner, obviously, to carry a firearm for my duties, it's a huge responsibility. So generally speaking, of course, any laws that would strengthen that, I mean, you know, I have four kids under the age of eight, so firearm security is very important to me and my household, and it should be for everybody. You've seen the crimes. Everybody's well aware of the, you know, I think going back to Sandy Hook, all the different tragedies that could have been averted by the safe storage of firearms. So, yeah, I mean, personally, my perspective, not taking an agency position, but I think it's common sense that anything that strengthens those types of laws will have that effect of people thinking twice, you know, and on how they store their firearms. Also in vehicles as well. That's a huge source, not necessarily here, but in some of the southern states, in Texas. IACP, everybody should watch it. Shaquille O'Neal just came out with this video on secure storage of firearms. It's entertaining, but it's also true to encourage members of the public to properly secure their firearms so they don't end up being used to kill a police officer or civilians, any one of our citizens. So personally support that.
Yeah, ISP does a lot of public safety education. That's a big part of what we do, and that is a constant mantra in terms of gun safety. And there is a huge number of firearms that are stolen by criminals, where it's not a straw purchaser, where it's not a whoops-a-daisy, you know, where did my gun go? It must have been lost or stolen. So it is a real challenge, and having better protection for those firearms, wherever they are, whether they're in your home, your car, those are measures that are common sense, responsible gun ownership.
This one is from Tenney Gross, Institute for Nonviolent Chicago. And we may have talked about this a bit. With 13,000 plus taken off Chicago streets annually, more than New York and L.A. combined, why can't we convert more into information to go after suppliers? At least I think I'm reading this correctly. We don't see many charges on gun sellers or suppliers.
So I'll say from ATF's perspective and our CJIC, yes, it is it's the highest volume in the United States. So for our two main programs I talked about, we trace the most guns and we have the most linked shootings of any city in the United States, including cities with far greater populations like New York, LA. So now that we've established that, how do you resource it? So again, you have to have a multi-agency effort to look at this, and you have to triage. So we look first at those guns that are used in crimes, shootings, homicides, and we triage kind of how we're going to go after those trafficking cases. And I will say it's a tall task for how we're resourced. ATF, I'll plug our agency's lack of resources here. We have 2,500 special agents across the country. So the enormity of this problem and the federal agency that's tasked with reducing firearms trafficking and gun violence, we have 2,500 special agents. But I will tell you from my perspective, the force multiplier of that partnership, sitting in real time like we do every morning and tracing those guns. We have five Chicago officers who are tracing guns constantly from the overnight reports. That's a change. So we're getting that information back quickly, and we're able to quickly identify those sources. There's already been a couple of good examples of that in our CJIC. But again, it requires that, for lack of a cliche, the whole of government approach, and one that we're doing here in Chicago.
And I can't underscore enough how few resources your office, like locally and then nationally, has received, and that's in part by design. And I think there are also implications for, of course, like the CJIC is in innovative technology, but my understanding is the process to trace guns is still quite like labor intensive and cumbersome, and even involves quite a bit of paper. So
absolutely,
there are, I think, aspects of the process of gun tracing that just make it hard to be efficient and quick, and again, in part by design, and that, of course, must have an impact on your ability to then quickly translate that information into something that's actionable. So the fact that the kind of Chicago group is able to do as much as they are, I think, is pretty incredible. But I would love for more people to kind of understand what actually goes into the process of tracing guns, and honestly, how hard it is to extract information from those traces if you are not incredibly specialized in, like, IT.
Well, and while we're on it, you know, a lot of us, you know, if you watch the true crime shows on television, or not even the true crime, like the fictional ones, you think that stuff is done, like, you know, within a matter of hours. We got a match. Let's go get the guy. Sounds like that's not really the case.
If only.
If only. Give us a sense.
Well, one thing so the tracing process is a manual process. So there's no database of firearms owners in the United States. We're banned by statute from having any such database here in the United States. So this process is a manual process. It's calling, getting back to the manufacturer where they ship that firearm. So. And then down to the original point of sale, having that dealer physically go and pull the record, the ATF Form 4473, and getting the information on the purchaser. That's a phone-a-friend type of process that occurs at our tracing center in Martinsburg, West Virginia. So the guns are covered in Chicago, the serial number, all that information sent to West Virginia, and the process starts from there. If it's a Glock, Taurus, Smith & Wesson, calling those manufacturers, okay, where did you ship the gun with this serial number, this caliber, and you go on from there. It can take less than 24 hours, so we will put the resources towards it. If it's a murder, high-profile crime, but typically can take anywhere from 3 days, depending upon the manufacturer, to up to 14 days to complete a routine trace. So we're talking about a delay in getting that back. In fact, our NIBIN program, we turn around the linked shootings within 48 hours. So we're getting back the linked shooting information sometimes before the trace.
One more question, and I think we're probably out of time, unless there are more questions, but I don't see them.
A quick follow-up.
There's going to be.
What did that share look like 10 years ago, say, like in turnaround time and being able to trace?
For tracing, has remained relatively the same. There has been some improvements that we've done as far as our relationships with the manufacturers that have sped that up. Now, the NIBIN's improved, has been a complete turnaround over the past 10 years as police departments have entered more information and we put out the best practices of getting your shell casings in immediately. I also plug the work of Director Kelly here at the State Police. We talk about these crime gun intelligence tools. Everybody has to use them for them to be successful. And I mentioned how small an agency are. We try to get around the state, but Director Kelly's done has engaged all of the agencies in Illinois to ensure that they're not only tracing firearms, but sharing their data back with the state police and law enforcement so we can identify those trafficking patterns. The Joyce Foundation also did a recent study on crime gun intelligence tools that talked about better ways to increase their use, because again, if you don't know about it, you can't disrupt that trafficker or that shooter if you're not tracing the gun and entering the shell casings in a timely manner.
And shout out to the Joyce Foundation for like maintaining that research, obviously, because I think we were talking about city data. I think the most recent is 2017, which it might be useful to have some fresh data.
Yeah, I would be very curious to see if, you know, those trends around source states, like, have they changed? If so, how? There have been tens of thousands of guns recovered since we last did that report. So I'd love to see a new one.
Inquiring minds want to know. I'm going to ask one more question that was previously or that's been submitted in advance. And this one is actually to you, Director Kelly, from Michael Rizzo, City Club member. The Illinois PICA assault weapons ban exempts possession and purchase of regulated assault firearms by police and retired police. If these firearms pose a danger to the public in Illinois, why are retired police allowed to possess them?
Well, I think it's because of the huge amount of training that's required. I think that was the balance that was made as the legislature was figuring out what to prioritize. There's a lot of triaging and, of course, a lot of sausage making, I think, in the legislative process.
So I
think that's true everywhere. But I think what does distinguish is the huge amount of training and the systems of accountability that are in there that your average citizen just doesn't have. And I think that was the reasonable justification.
Okay. I think, there we are. Hey, Dan, I think we're out of time. Please help me thank our panelists.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Brandis. Brandis, as you know, you're welcome back anytime. We always appreciate when you guide us in these amazing conversations. Yeah, thank you, Director Kelly, and ATF Special Agent Chris Ammon. I hope I didn't mispronounce it.
Charge.
Special agent in charge. Thank you for that.
Not of my household, though.
And Kim Smith, thank you so much for all of your insights. I believe we made a difference here. I learned a lot, and I think that hopefully, like you said, we got towards some solutions and are stepping forward one step at a time, one life, one gun, one bullet even at a time is such a huge difference in the city. So thank you for your time, your insights. Thank you for all of you for being here and for all that you do every day. Get back to it. We've all got busy lives. Thanks for being here at City Club. We welcome you back very soon. Thanks.